Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Bob. I am alcoholic. And through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through the process in here, good sponsorship, and a consistent, persistent commitment to the primary purpose of self-forgetting and helping God's kids, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. Sometimes I say that and I go, really? Thank you for the great introduction. If you took that same CD and you played it backwards, you'd hear, Clancy is Satan. Don't let him get this talk. I'll get some bad direction out of that one, I'll tell you. Dave says to me, leans over and says, how come you get two gorgeous girls? I said, because God loves me. I'll tell Dave anything. I just love him. Ever since that incident at the petting zoo, I figured out he won't judge me for nothing. oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't supposed to share that, was I? There's another name on my eight-step list. Sorry, Dave. I'm delighted to be here. There's a lot of old friends here. The talks have been spectacular. I could listen to Sandy read the phone book. And I'd tell you, and I'd hear God talking. I'm telling you. I just love listening to him. I have since I got sober. One of the earlier CDs I ever heard was from 1976. It was a cassette. From 1976, my first sponsor and one of my dearest friends spoke in Hawaii with Sandy at the same conference, and he brought me that. He gave me that CD of Sandy, and it was just, it lit me up. That's when he was talking about drop the rock. And I had a rock. And Sheldon gave a great talk. So did Bill, Polly. I've always enjoyed Polly. Bob. I heard Bob Thursday night. We got here and we went over to hear him talk at a local group. Got some great speakers coming up. Good panel tonight. My job is just not to screw up the weekend. I don't want to be the one guy that. Yeah, everybody goes, boy, that was a great conference, except for that guy from Vegas, you know. Of course, my hope is that they might think it was Sheldon. I'm supposed to talk about something that is dear to me because of the results of it in my life, but yet, more than anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the one thing that terrified me the most, and that was step 8 and 9. I can sort of do most of the rest of it. I mean, I'd spent years in therapy, so the fourth and fifth step was not that big of a deal for me. The God thing was that I had my certain barriers and prejudices to get through and old ideas to abandon. But once I was able to do that, and I'm good with that. But this eighth and ninth step frightened me. I remember sitting in meetings and listening to people talking about their experiences. And you know, some of you newer people might find this hard to believe. People in AA have a tendency to dramatize their own stories a little bit. So I'd hear these people tell these horrendous amends stories, and people, and some guys would be like, there's almost pounding the table, and I paid back every dime, and I thought, oh my god, I I lived like a crazy person on the streets. I mean, pay back every dime. I mean, oh, God, I remember thinking to myself, I'm in my 20s. I'm a young guy. If I had a good job and I worked for 50 years and used every dime I made, I would never pay. I couldn't pay it back in a lifetime. It was just too big. It was too overwhelming. It was, I couldn't imagine it. I just, it freaked me out. There were people, I thought, my God, some of these people, if I faced them, they're going to take a baseball bat to me. I'm in Las Vegas and not in Pennsylvania because some of those people. I had 2 years in a state penitentiary hanging over my head. That was, in my mind, was a done deal. I'd already been sentenced. And the judge, kind judge, stayed the commitment and said, we're not going to carry out this sentence. We're going to put you in a place for a year that I could have stayed in and would have stayed in for a year if they'd have let me drink there. But, I mean, I can't stay in there and stay sober. I mean, that's a lot to ask for a guy with my emotional disposition. And so I got to Vegas on the run. And I have a mother and father that I... The problem is I always loved my mom and dad. I always loved them. I tried hard to blame them. I went to therapists and talked about how I couldn't even come up with stuff. Well, I go from one extreme to the other. Well, my dad was always gone working all the time. And then the next session, they were always there on, and, you know, smothering me. And, you know, it's like, well, make up your mind, which... And I'm always trying to hang stuff on them. But that's what you do when you hurt people and you owe them. You got to blame them. Right? And I couldn't imagine ever making any of it right. I knew it was too late for some of that stuff. And if you're new here and your feelings about step eight and nine may very well be like mine, where it was horrifying to me. And I want you to know something, that you're not there right this minute if you're new. There's some stuff's going to happen to you. You're going to get an infusion of grace if you do the first 7 steps. And I can't explain to you how this is going to happen. I just know it's going to happen. It always happens. Is that what is impossible eventually becomes possible in God's hands and in God's time. It's a very synchronistic endeavor. Synchronistic was a word that Carl Jung came about, and it's a beautiful view of the universe. It's a universe that exists to accommodate desire. And from the moment, a synchronistic universe is a universe for if I need to get from point A to point B, but there's something in the middle that can't be overcome, and I can't get from point A to point B from the moment of the desire, the universe starts almost like this giant massage as it moves slowly and shifts slowly, and eventually the impossible becomes possible. And that truly is my story. And this anxiety towards step 8 and 9 is something I found out has permeated Alcoholics Anonymous since the very beginning. In a peculiar sense, AA was founded on one man's 8th step. Dr. Bob Smith got sober Mother's Day weekend. He had this conversation at the gatehouse with Bill Wilson, who lit him up, and he'd never heard anybody talk like that, and he identified and made the connection, and Bill had outlined this program of action that he was gleaning from the Oxford group, and Bob liked it all. He liked the confession of shortcomings, he liked the prayer and meditation, the seeking guidance from God, he liked the helping other people. He wasn't going to do the amends thing. He told Bill something to the effect of, you know, I'm a doctor in this community. I've already screwed up my reputation. Let's leave that alone. And so he did everything that Bill suggested, his sponsor suggested, except that. And consequently, Dr. Bob Smith drank again. and he went to a medical convention in Atlantic City, came back, ended up in Akron on what, and came to, was eventually ended up back in Ardmore Street after he was laid on the, he was so drunk coming off the train, they laid him on the platform at the Akron station. Eventually they got him back to the house in Ardmore Street, came to on what today they believe was June 17th, because some people have researched, but originally we adopted it, we believed it was June 10th, and we've adopted that as our Founders Day, the day we believe Dr. Bob got sober. But regardless of the day, Dr. Bob came to that morning, and as I came to hundreds of times, hundreds, just were you drinking around the clock? Because when I drank exactly like Dr. Bob. I mean, I when I start, I can't stop. I'm that guy. I forego eating. I forego everything just for the next drink. I'm the kind of alcoholic, and Bob, I think, was like this. I could drink and pass out. I could get drunk three, sometimes four times in one day. Now, you do that for a week or two, you're sick because you're not eating. Your blood sugar's whacked. You're in bad shape. And he came to with the tremors, just bad, bad tremors as I used to come to. I used to sit on the edge of the bed or couch or floor or park bench or wherever I was. And I just grab myself and rock like I want to jump out of my skin. And my nerves are shot, and Bob's nerves were shot. And he asked what day it was, and they told him, and he freaked out. It was early in the morning, and it can't be today. Oh, my God, I have a surgery to perform today. And Dr. Bob was a proctologist, so you can use your imagination about what kind of surgery it was. Imagine being the patient. Bill Wilson gave him a sedative and a couple beers and, you know, into the surgery you go. Imagine being the patient, watching your doctor shaking and smelling like beer. I mean, oh, my God, we should build a statue of that guy somewhere. My friend Bill Pittman told me he searched the Akron City Hospital and St. Thomas Hospital records trying to find out more information about this guy. They couldn't. He wanted to know, flesh the story out a little bit. What happened to the guy? All we know is he lived, but did he whistle when he walked or what? We don't know. But he lived. And Dr. Bob, that surgery was over quick. Evidently, it was a little small cancer surgery, and it was over still in the morning, and he disappeared. Disappeared and nobody knew where he was. And Bill, his son, sat in my house and told us the story we talked about it. He talked to a whole bunch of us about it and how everybody was worried. And they thought that Bill was drinking. Or they thought that Bob, rather, was drinking. And Bill thought that because he'd given him the beer and sent him in there. And he didn't come back till all that morning, all that afternoon. I think his son said it was really late, maybe even close to midnight by the time he came home. And he hadn't been drinking, and there was something different about him. And they discovered that he'd been out searching out everyone he was afraid to face. And finally, one man was willing to go to any lengths. And in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in the synopsis of the program Recovery, it mentions that term, willing to go to any lengths. But then it defines it and really talks about it at great depth within the section on amends. As it mentions, that it uses it again twice. That's really when we say in Alcoholics Anonymous, willing to go to any lengths, is, are you willing to face the people you're afraid to face? Are you willing to pay the people back that don't know that you owe them? The problem with pay, they don't know you owe them. Maybe nobody knows you owe them, that you're the one that ripped them off. You're the one that got the money. Maybe there's only one person on the face of the earth that knows that you ripped them off. But it's the worst person that could know. It's the only person that has the ability to take that information and use it to sabotage your life. You. The worst person that could know it knows it. I understand that. I've experienced the karmactic shifts in my own life as a result of taking actions that I didn't believe would work, that I didn't think would make a difference, that I thought had something to do with some kind of high moral issue, and really it wasn't at all. It had to do with my spiritual condition and aligning myself with God and consequently with his kids, and so that there would be a rightness in here and a freedom so I can walk free on this earth. And my dear friend, I had a dear friend in AA who died years ago, and we used to talk mostly every week, a guy named Clint Hodges, and Clint used to say something that was, well, he'd say it and people would get nervous. He'd say, there's a world of difference between making all your amends and all your amends but one. And, oh, there is. Because you know the one you're not making, it's the really, it should have been top of the list. We don't hold out the insignificant ones. It's the ones we hold out are the ones that are probably the most important. And I get sober in 1978, and I got a sponsor, and I told this man, I said, I'll do everything you ask me to do. And there had been many times I've regretted that sent statement, because the people in AA, they got stuff they want you to do. And it's, people in Alcoholics Anonymous are funny. If you come to meetings, as I did for several years, and you act like, leave me alone, we leave you alone. I mean, there's always somebody that just got off their meds that don't, but for the most part, we leave you alone. We respect that. You sit there like, screw you. We just kind of walk around you. But man, the minute you reach out for help, people in Alcoholics Anonymous are all over it. They're all over it to this day. And I didn't know that by reaching out for help, I was going to invite these busybody kind of people poking their nose into my life. You know what I mean? Asking me crazy questions like, so where's your mom and dad? Oh, they're in Pennsylvania. Well, so how are they doing? I don't know. I haven't talked to them in several years. Oh, so, well, you need to make amends to your mom and dad. No, that's not going to work. It's too late for that. Oh, no, you really need to make amends. I said, listen, they won't even take my calls. You know what they said? Don't call collect. I would have never thought of that. Honest to God, that sounds like a simple thing. I would have never thought of that. I had some, this egocentric personality I have has these bizarre senses of entitlement. Or I'm a user. And I would have never thought of calling my mother and father and not calling collect, because I'm a taker. I'm a user. I'm an opportunist. And they said, don't call collect. And they pushing me to call my parents. I said, this isn't any good. They told me to not only call, but start writing them little letters. And I had this little pathetic little job making minimum wage, and they said, you must never miss Father's Day, Mother's Day, their anniversaries, their birthdays, or Christmas. You have to get them something. You have to buy them a gift. And this is non-negotiable. And I okay. And I remember the first time I called my mother, she answers the phone, and the minute she hears my voice, oh, this hostile vibe came out of the phone. Like, what do you want? And then a panic creeped into her voice, and she said, oh, my God, you're not back in Pennsylvania, are you? I said, no, Mom, I'm in Nevada. She says, Nevada? Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. Her voice shrieked. It went up an octave. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. It was like, But I get that right back, even coming out of the startlingness of that, she got off that phone quick. She didn't want to talk to me. But you know that what do you want, get off the phone, I don't want to talk to you attitude is, I mean, it's what happens when someone loves you deeply and you break their heart over and over and over. And Polly was talking about people get their heart broke open. Some people get their heart broke closed and sealed up tight like a steel wall. And I thought this is hopeless. But I kept taking the actions that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous did. I remember Christmas came, and they told me I had to get my parents both a present. I got my mom a little tiny thing of the perfume she likes, and I Got my dad a necktie. It was like a $8 or $9 necktie. It was pathetic. I mean, I owe my father so much money from loans and stuff, that if I got him a house on the beach, it wouldn't even touch how far behind I am with him. And I gave him this little pathetic necktie. I wouldn't have done it, because if you hadn't have made me, you made me do it. And I did it. And you know something? For a moment, it lit my dad up, and the wall came down, and then he put it right back up again. Because that's what, you get hurt enough, that's what you do. There were times I was discouraged. There was times I was even angry that my parents, you know, after a couple months of this, you know, why don't I put back in the will? Why don't I brought back into the family, for God's sakes? And it's so ludicrous on my part. The book says 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And there is. Long period. Chamberlain, my grand sponsor, used to rub his hands together and say, "We rub away the wreckage with good works." And that's what you were encouraging me to do. You're encouraging me to rub away something I didn't think was rub awayable. And I just did it and did it. And I was about a year sober. I'd been doing all this that you told me to do for a year. And my mother and father decided, they told me they were going to come out to Las Vegas. They're coming out to eyeball me is what they're doing. They're not coming out for a homecoming. They're coming out with a skepticism and as if I'm probably still a bum who's trying to con them and get back into their good graces long distance. And they don't think I've changed, really. Because I've one of the worst things I did to my mother and father, and I did this for better than a decade, is I'd get back up on my feet and I'd get their hopes up just to smash them even worse. And every time it's worse to be on the receiving end of that. Because it's tough. And they came out to just thinking, well, if he is a bum, we've never been to Las Vegas, it won't be a complete loss. And they came out, and I met him at the airport, and they had a room at the Stardust Hotel, and I took him out to dinner with my sponsor and his wife who's passed away many, many years ago. And we went to a nice, I told my sponsor, I said, I want to take him to a really nice restaurant. And I got a job, you know, I got this job, I'm making, I don't know, $120 a week or something. I don't know, something like that, not much more. And I had never been to an expensive, I had no idea what an expensive restaurant, I had to pull my sponsor aside and borrow the money, because it was more, the check was more than my take home in a week. It was unbelievable. And my sponsor suggested that I invite them to my home group. And my home group was a remarkable group. It was there's not many groups. This first group, it sort of deteriorated over the years, but all the old timers seemed to go to that group. It was an AA and Al-Anon family meeting, and it met in people's homes. And the people's homes that it met in were nice homes, because you'd have to accommodate 40 to 60 people in your living room, so that cuts out a lot of apartments and stuff. And so it was in nice homes, and the people there were very friendly, and they had great desserts. And they said, take them there. And I didn't want to take them there. I felt kind of almost like ashamed that I had to go to AA. But I invited them there, and they didn't know anything about AA. They'd never had, nobody in our family had ever went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out later that I had some uncles and aunts and a grandmother on one side and a grandfather on the other that were alcoholic, but it was very well hidden. Nobody talked about it. Most of them were periodics. I was the first person in my family to ever go to AA. I was the first person in my family to ever go to prison, go to jail. I was the first person in my family to ever end up in a psychiatric ward. I was the first person in my family had ever stuck a hypodermic needle in his arm for recreational purposes. I was the first person that ever put things up his nose. I was the first person that ever did beer bongs. I was the first person that ever had DTs or had to be detoxed. I was kind of a pioneer in a way, I guess. Someone has to do it. So they didn't know anything about any of this. And I brought them to my home group, and it was a spectacular meeting. It was comprised of a lot of old-timers that were very involved in service. And these were the kind of guys that were on fire in AA, and they laughed a lot. And they screwed with the new people all the time. I mean, just... Oh, if you had a problem, the level of mirth your problem would create for them was amazing. It just did that. Oh, they just laugh. Oh, that's great. And they get to see me being picked on by the old timers, and my Dick Toussaint was one of the big picker honors. He'd pick on all of us, and he does that to this day. He's just got a great sense of humor. And then there was there were guys that I ran around with, and I ran with a pack of guys, and we were on fire. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing, but we were doing a lot of service and a lot of 12-step work. We hadn't read the book yet, so we were carrying the disease more than the message. But we were on fire. We were the AA stormtroopers, and we'd go to the detox in the prison, and we're gonna beat these people into sobriety, you know. So the old timers would look good, And they got to see me with not only the guys I run around with, but the newer guys. And we pick on the newer guys. Now, we're not sober that long. I'm sober a year, and I'm picking on people with a month. But AA functions on the first rule of plumbing, that crap runs downhill. And all of that was a tremendous feeling of love and laughter and camaraderie in that group. And my parents loved it. I don't know that my dad... My dad died right before I think I was 6 years sober, I guess, and I don't know that he ever understood it like my mom did. My mom later came to really, really understand AA and be as a non-alcoholic person, go to a lot of me. That's a whole other story, but she was amazing. But right before, I remember sitting in there at my home group, and someone's talking about getting their kids back. And my mom leaning over to my dad, kind of teared up a little bit, saying, "This is great." And right before they left to go back to Pennsylvania, I was instructed to write out, to the best of my ability, all the money I borrowed from my father and mother over the years. And it was a lot. It was, I mean, just many times that I would have warrants or fines that I had to pay, and they'd loan me the money to pay the fine. Where I'd drank away my rent money, and they would loan me the money so I wouldn't be thrown on the streets, or my car would fall apart, and they'd loan me the money to get it fixed, and a lot of stuff. And I put it all on paper. I did as I was advised. I came up with a game plan, a proposal to my dad about making payments, which I thought was just pathetic, making payments. It's not that I don't want to pay him, but I'd like to hit the lottery and do it in a big check, you know, like get a pat on the back and all. They told me that you sold your integrity a nickel and a dime at a time, you'll buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time. It just seemed pathetic to me. And I'm looking at it, and I figured it out. It was 12 and a half years of payments. When you're a year sober, 12 and a half years of payments is, shoot me, it's a lifetime. But they said, you just pay it, it's just you'll get used to it after a while. I thought, yeah, I don't know. They say that about sex in prison too, but I don't think so. So... I go sit down in the coffee shop, the Stardust Hotel, with my mother and father, and present my proposition of payment to them. And my dad says to me, he says, "Rob, we don't want you to pay back the money." He said, "We're just delighted you're sober. This is the first time in years that we thought maybe you might be okay. Just keep doing that AA thing and just stay sober and forget about the debt." Well, my God, I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. This is amazing. This is very cool. I just left there. Man, I'm on a cloud nine. I'm on my way over to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news, fantasizing about other people I owe. Wonder if I get them to see the light like my parents did. I'll mention my service commitments. And I get to my sponsor's office, and I tell him the good news, and he said, it doesn't matter what your dad said. This is your debt. This is your recovery. This is your integrity. This is your spiritual well-being. You've got to make that right. And there are times you just have a bad sponsor. It's just a... Because he's raining on my parade. I mean, this is not a willful deal. And I didn't know that the ego doesn't have to be proactive. It can be opportunistic also. And selfishness is often opportunistic. And he said, you have to find a way to pay him. And I don't think there's a way to do that. My dad said they're not mega rich or anything, but they're comfortable. And if I just send them a little check every month, they're not even going to cash it. I don't see any way I can make this right. And he said this crazy thing. He says it to this day. I've heard him say this for the last 33 and a half years. He says, I don't know, but a way will be shown. And I said, I don't know, but a way will be shown. What the heck? What's that mean? I mean, jeez. So I file that away. All right, I got to make that amends. And I'm working as a cashier in a store. And back in the 70s, there was a lot of silver coins in circulation and wheat pennies and silver certificates and even gold certificates and silver quarters. There were still a lot of silver half dollars in circulation, occasionally even silver dollars. We'd see them come through the register. And my dad collected that stuff, and it was a hobby that he was very enthusiastic about. I remember watching him sit for hours with the books and the bags of coins and putting them, some of them in slots and, you know, all that stuff. And I thought maybe I could save, my boss had let me buy this stuff out of the register, maybe I could save enough of it to give my dad one day a really nice present. Never thinking that I was going to absolve the debt with that. That would be ludicrous. But just to give my dad a nice present, it seemed like a nice thing to do. And I talked to my boss, and he said, fine. And I started doing that, buying that stuff out of there. There were several occasions that we get those $100 gold certificates would come through there, and my boss would have to stick them in his office in the safe for a couple weeks till I had enough money to buy them. And I'm chipping away at some other amends, and there's a couple other things I've done, and I started getting lucky. Now, I am not a guy that gets as lucky, but some good fortune starts coming my way, and I think that it is serendipitous. I think that there's a cause and effect in this. I can't prove it. I know people that are skeptical. They think it's coincidences. What coincidence maybe is God trying to remain anonymous. I don't know, but some amazing things started happening in my life materially, and they weren't serving me as much at that time as they later did, but they were at that time they were serving this process. And I started getting raises and bonuses, and I got a better job and a better job. There was a guy in AA who had a moving truck and a little moving business, moving furniture, and he would he'd try to schedule his moves around my time off, when shifts I wasn't working or days off, and so I could help him. And I found myself in about 4 years or less, I got into saving all this stuff, and I had it face value, the entire debt, plus a little bit actually. I had a shoebox full of silver and gold certificates. I couldn't hardly lift it. Bag of silver quarters and wheat pennies and war nickels and a big bag of half dollars and a bunch of and some silver dollars and dimes, a ton of dimes, ton of. And I drove back to Pennsylvania with Karen, who's a girl that I was engaged to at the time, who would later become the mother of my daughter, and we went back to Pennsylvania, and I gave that stuff to my dad. Now, by the time I give this stuff to my dad, I'm sober probably close to maybe 5 years. I don't know, close to 5 years, I suppose, or somewhere. Chronologically, I'm a little challenged, but somewhere in there. And I've had so many conversations and so many visits with him now. They like to come out to Vegas a lot, and I'd see them several times a year, and we had a good relationship. And my dad, I had made all the verbal amends. My dad had forgiven me. There was no doubt that he'd forgiven me. There was no doubt that he loved me. But there was still something between me and him, and I don't know how much of it was imagined and how much of it was born out of the inside of me and how much of it was actually in him. But there was a little bit of a vague something ain't right between me and him. I knew he loved me. I knew he forgave me. But I was like Bob. You know Bob. It's our son Bob. You got to make allowances for Bob. Our daughter graduated from this great university. Bob's in a 12-step program. You know, I was like special bus Bob. You know what I mean? I mean, he never said that. Now, I don't know how much of this is imagined, but I felt like I'm like the kid that's coming from behind. You know, I just had that feeling. And when I gave him those coins, it seemed to shift. And it seemed like, to me, looking back, it was like the first time in my life I became a man in my father's eyes. It blew his mind. He never expected it. It blew his mind. And our whole relationship changed. And I had about a year, maybe, or less, probably, with him before he died. And it was sweet. It was sweet. I miss him. I miss him to this day. I know that most of the things that are innate in me that are really of great value came from him. He was a very principled man, and yet his spirit is alive within me. When my daughter was born, I felt his presence in the delivery room. I felt it when I sold my business and I got the first big check. I swear to God, I could hear his voice say, "Rob, you did good." And I went back to Pennsylvania at his death, and I was able to be there for my mother and my sister, and I was able to bury him without ghosts. And I know about ghosts. When my grandfather died, I was haunted for years by the ghosts of the things I'd done to break his heart. I was haunted by the ghosts of the things I never said to him that I should have, the things I never thanked him for, the things I was too self-centered and too self-obsessed to even appreciate. What an amazing grandfather he'd been to me as a little kid. And Alcoholics Anonymous had a remedy for that. There's a part in the book that said some people can't be seen. So we send them an honest letter, and my grandfather was dead. So I wrote him an honest letter. And in that letter, I told him everything I would yearn to tell him across a kitchen table. I told him how sorry I was on the morning of his wife of, I think, 60 years, the morning of her funeral, how he had to find me in the guest bedroom in his house covered with blood and a hypodermic needle stuck in my arm, and he thought I was dead because I'd found the drugs she'd been on before she died. And I told him in that letter how sorry I was to have done that to him on the worst day of his life. I thanked him and for the graciousness and the love and the money he'd spent on me as a kid and how he used to just like to buy me things. And he was my pap, my grandpap. And I thanked him for that. And I took that letter. I wrote everything I wanted to say to him in that letter. I told him how sorry I was. I disappointed him. He wanted me to be a doctor. I wanted to be a doctor, too. I just didn't want to go to school. Well, you can't put You can't put a guy like me on a college campus where it's go to class or go to the keg party. The class loses every single time. I mean, I said all that. I took it out in the desert, sat on a rock, and read it, and wept, and got closure with my grandfather. Something changed inside of me. It sounds crazy. It sounds like voodoo or something. But I tell you, I experienced this, and something shifted within inside me as a result of that. Many years later, I went back to Pennsylvania and went to his gravesite, and my whole family's in one whole area, and I was able to. It was an amazing emotional experience. Some new guy in the car waiting for me. He didn't know what to. He's worried about the guy that's sober a long time, walking through gravestones weeping. I don't. One of the more difficult amends I've ever had to make was, I've had several I've had to make for things I've done sober. I don't like that. I really don't like me. See, it's not so bad making amends for stuff you did when you were drinking. You can kind of hang it on the hook of, well, my God, I was messed up, for God's sakes. But as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the bite's a little sharper. And I've had, oh God, in relationships, I get into arguments with people and things, and I'm pretty good with that restraint of tongue and pen for a while. And you come at me long enough, and eventually I say something that I don't like myself for, and then I have to make amends. And oh, I hate making amends. I think it's the nuclear deterrent of the spirit. You know, there's a lot of things in my life I really do not go near, and I don't touch that, and I don't go there. Not because I became a good guy. I just don't want to pay the price. I don't want to have that thing happen to me that happens to me when I do that, when I take actions that, in essence, I'm acting like someone that, from a distance afar, I don't like. And when I act like someone I don't like, I feel about them the way I'd feel about someone else who did to someone I cared about what I just did to them. Right? And so there's a lot of things I don't do, or I really try hard to stay away from. I try not even get into the zip code of certain things because I don't want a chance that I'm going to do something that I'm going to pay a price for later. But I had this amends. It was about a year. When I was about a year sober, I'm working as this cashier, and one day I was at work, and I had a bad cigarette addiction in those days, which is a whole other story of how I could not quit smoking, and how I did a couple prayers, and I consistently did them for months, and something shifted inside of me, and something happened. But at that time, I had about a 3-pack-a-day habit. I mean, I would light cigarettes off of cigarettes. You know, I was that kind of guy. There was a security in just having one somewhere burning. You know what I mean? And I was at work one Thursday, and Friday's payday, and I'm broke. I'm living paycheck to paycheck at best, trying to pay some of these amends and just get by. And I'm at work, and I run out of cigarettes. And we sold cigarettes in the store I worked at. And so this little voice in my head, it's so friendly sounding, isn't it? It's so seductive. It says, "Bob, you're jonesing for a cigarette. Just take a pack of cigarettes, and tomorrow when you get your paycheck, you'll cash it and ring it up. This is not even wrong, Bob." I said, "Okay. Thank you, nice voice." I took the pack of cigarettes and I smoked them. And the next day I go into work and I cash my paycheck out of the bank like we always do. And the good voice says, "You better ring those cigarettes up." And that other voice, it's always more seductive, isn't it? It's more gentle and understanding. It says to me, "Well, Bob, for God's sakes, you come to work early. You stay late. You work harder than everybody else here. It's only a pack of cigarettes, for God's sakes. Everybody does this kind of thing. Probably factored into the cost of operation. And I never rang those cigarettes up, and I didn't even know it, but I opened a door, and I started supporting a three-pack-a-day habit by stealing. I don't think I bought. I had to be out somewhere away from where it was rare in the next probably a year that I bought a pack of cigarettes anywhere. And then in no time at all, I'm taking Diet Coke, six packs of Diet Coke, because once you start stealing, what the heck? You know what I mean? And I started doing that, and I started getting really sick. And, you know, in our book, it talks about this, the world or the realm of the spirit. And I've noticed something peculiar with me, is that I can take some actions over here that are spiritually debilitating, but the evidence of that debilitation doesn't show up in that arena immediately. It shows up over here and over here and over there, and then eventually it shows up over there. That's like almost the last place it shows up because of the deviousness. One of the greatest tricks the ego has ever done is to convince me it doesn't exist. It's a great shift changer. And so I start getting sick in all these areas. And one of the things that started happening to me is I didn't want to go to AA meetings anymore. And I remember this. I remember being in a meeting, just storming out of there thinking, listen to all these people with these platitudes and all this stuff, thinking, these people in AA are liars. They're phony. They're hypocrites. And I don't know that what I'm doing, I have no idea, is I'm projecting this unconscious sense of myself as a result of my actions onto you. See, I'm the hypocrite here. I'm the guy who's stealing from his boss every day, going to AA meetings and trying to have, as it talks about in Into Action, the living the double life. My stage character that I present to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous is Bob with his spiritual suit on, and then the guy I know I really am. I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, and I'm a thief. And eventually it caught up with me, and I'm starting to mentally tear apart the guy I work for and everybody else. I mean, it's bad. And I get down on my knees one night because I've had good training in Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning. They told me to get down on my knees twice a day, and then talk to God throughout the day. And I was getting on my knees just simply to thank Him for that day of sobriety. And I didn't know about the 11th step self-examination yet. And I was on my knees to thank God for that day of sobriety. And I'm in bad shape here. As a matter of fact, I was starting to thinking about drinking again. Now I'd sweep it under the rug because it wasn't like a full-blown obsession. But one of the things in the store, we sold all kinds of stuff. But one of the things we sold was alcohol. And they, I tell you, when you're in fit spiritual condition, what it talks about in the 10th step is really true. You can be around it. If you're placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, it's like selling shoes. It doesn't mean anything. The bottles don't talk to me. They have no seduction or power. It's just something that's just merchandise. But man, after I've been stealing for a while, I remember being at work one day and a guy came in and he wanted to buy this stuff. I'd never heard of it. It didn't exist when I was out there. It's called Jägermeister. And I guess it just came out. We just had some, just got it in, didn't know much about it. I didn't know anything about it. And this guy's telling me about this Jägermeister. He says, oh, my God, it's like the best alcohol buzz you ever had, coupled with cocaine and opium, and it's really amazing. And I went, really? And I'm looking at that bottle, and it had kind of a sort of a Germanic, a magical Germanic label, and it was like Jägermeister. No, I'm not cracking a lid or nothing, but I'm looking at it. It's got power again. Because why? Because lack of power is my dilemma, and I have cut myself off from any source of power that comes to me, either through me, directly from God or through you directly, indirectly from God. I'm cut off from you, and I'm cut off from God. And I yearn for something. All of a sudden, alcohol starts looking like medicine again to me. Medicine for this malady of my spirit. And I get down on my knees that night, and I'm thanking God for that day of sobriety. And I just screamed out, I'm not going to use the words I used, but God, what the is going on? And this instantaneously, the moment I asked the question, it was like a veil lifted up, and I knew what was going on. I didn't like it, but I knew what was going on. And there was a flood of shame that just started coming into me because what a phony I am. And I started doing the math about, I'd been stealing now for a long time, and I started figuring it out, and it's a bunch. And I don't have the money. And I know, and I'm afraid I'm going to drink, and I just get this sense, man, I got to go make this right. I got to go make it right. And scared me. I know that the guy I got to face has my boss has zero tolerance for employee theft. I mean, zero. I watched him throw a guy out, threatened to have him arrested. In retail, it's understandable. You can't have any, because an employee can just destroy you. And you got to be able to trust the people that handle your merchandise and your money. And I have to go face this guy, and I know, I am convinced I'm going to lose my job. And then I'm going to have to go find another job so that I can make payments. I don't have the money. I'm going to have to go find another job to make payments. And how am I going to get another job? I mean, now I got another huge blank spot on my resume. I have a lot of those, unexplained. Well, what did you do for those 3 years? Sold blood and drugs and stole and how do you hook that up? And I might have a hard time getting a job. And the guy that I got to go face has heard me one time pontificate about my program of rigorous honesty. I'll tell you what I learned from that. Never trust anybody who goes out of their way to tell you how honest they are. I tell you, I know some people I believe are very honest, and they'll tell you that you get them afraid enough, they're liable to lie to you. It might make amends later. And I had to go see this guy, and I prayed myself right up to it, and I remember talking. I started telling him about it, and he got pissed at me. He started yelling at me. And what he's yelling at me is, I can't argue with it. He had really been very good to me. And I just broke his heart. And when he's done yelling at me, I realized that he hadn't fired me. And I said, I still have my job. And he, yeah, you're going to pay it all back. And I went, oh, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And I sat down with a piece of paper, and I figured out to the best of my ability how much it was. I added on another 10%, another $50, and I did it because I was so ashamed of myself, and I wanted to be free of this so badly that I would rather overestimate it and get free of it than underestimate it. And let me tell you something. If I'm trying to figure something like this out and I'm wrong, it ain't going to be wrong in your favor. You know what I mean? I'm just that wired that way. I mean, I started making those payments, and within 30 days, the book says we're amazed before we're halfway through. Before I was even halfway through those payments, I loved working there again. I mean, I really, really liked it. I remember telling people at a meeting that I just like my job, man. I like waiting on people and taking care of people and being of service, and I like the other employees. I like my boss. I thought, I didn't get much money working there, but I thought I could work here forever. I'm cool here. And within 30 days of making the last payment, I was not looking for another job. I had a home here, and a guy came to me out of nowhere. I was not looking for a job, and offered me a job with a chance for management and to make about twice as much money. And I went to my boss, and I told him about it, and he said, well, you can't pass that up. And I went to work for this other guy, and which led to another position. And eventually I was running a place, and I'm making more money, and I'm getting bonuses, and I'm chipping away at all these other amends. And quite a while went by, and I'm rocking and rolling. My life is really good, better than I would have ever imagined when I was new. And I went into a restaurant one night, a Denny's, and the guy I'd worked for and robbed and paid back is sitting in there with his wife. And I went up and started talking to him because we were pretty good friends. And I asked him how things are going. He said, well, did you hear about me selling the store? And I had heard a little bit about that. And I said, yeah. I said, well, how'd that go? And he said, it fell apart. I was selling it to a guy from Korea, and because of the slot machines and the liquor license and the tobacco, they have to pass this extensive test investigation by the FBI and for the gaming license especially. And he said the guy had the store for 6 months, and he said he kind of ran it into the ground and then denied his license. I got it back in my lap. And he said, I'm not real happy about that. He said, I thought I was going to be able to retire. I was burnt out. He said, I guess it's not in the cards. And I said to him something that if I hadn't paid him back, I would have never been able to say. I'm even surprised to this day that I was able to say it, because it was such a ludicrous statement. It was a silly statement. I said to him, man, I'd like to buy your store. And then the minute I said it, I felt embarrassed that I said it, because I don't have any money. And then I had to tell him, well, but I don't have any money. I'm just kidding, you know. Just like, nice thought. And he said to me, he says, what's your day off? And I told him, he said, meet me down here. And I met him there for lunch, and he sitting in this booth. I remember he had this some kind of those tan folders and some papers and stuff there. And I sat down, and he made me a proposition that if I were to come back and run that business, and he said it's not doing very well. It's probably quite a ways in the red. He said, but if you can get it back strong into the black and make it profitable again, you will earn a piece of it every year. And at the end of 5 years, he says, I'd like to be out of here if you can bring it up to the right numbers. And then I'll be done, and you'll still make some payments on fixtures and inventory, et cetera, et cetera. But that'll be my portion. I'll be out of it, and I'll be free. It'll be all yours. And he said, what did you think? And I'm a guy I never did graduate from high school, even though I did flunk out of some of the finer universities. I got a resume that it just is pathetic. I mean, it's the only thing on there that looks good at all, and I can't do that anymore, is I was a counselor at one time, and I was actually very good until I got lost the job for being drunk on the job. I was actually a very good alcoholism counselor. And I was amazed. I said, man, I would love to do that. And by this time, I'd had a conversation 2 years or so before, a couple years before, with Chuck Chamberlain. He taught me how to go to work. He saved me from quitting my ninth job. Right, it was the job I had right before this came up. And Chuck had told me how to go to work. He said, kid, you got to forget yourself. You got to go to work for one reason only. That's to help God's kids. He said, all that stuff, what you're getting paid, how much you're appreciated, none of your business. You go to work to help his kids, to be helpful, be of service. And I went to work for this company, went into this partnership, and I went there every day to be of service. And I was on fire, and I loved it. And that company, that store was grossing about $600,000, a little less, I think, when I took it over. And I think at one point, we never hit $10 million, but we were close on a couple occasions. I didn't actually want to go to $10 million because it takes, puts you in another thing with the IRS, a whole different ballgame. But we just kept getting close. And I sold that company. By the time I sold it, we had five stores. I sold that company many years ago, actually. It's been quite a few years now. I was able to retire in pretty good shape. I mean, in such good shape, I thought I'd never have to worry about money the rest of my life. And God loves people who think that kind of stuff. And had a couple years of where I really have learned how to trust God. It's easy to trust God when you got a couple hundred grand in the bank and you're worth $5 or $6 million. It's when you see it all start to go down the drain and you don't know where the bottom is. That's when I have to remind myself of the truth. The book calls it the great reality. that we find it only one place. You don't find it in a checkbook. You don't find it in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though it will speak in meetings. You find it deep down within you. Even when I hear God talk through you, the receptor is deep down within me that resonates and knows and makes that connection. And so I was able to retire from that business. And over the years, I've had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of guys and helping them to walk them through amends. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more fantastic than that, because this is the big show here. When you get to watch relationships change, when you get to watch men and women who have been just depressive people who have been part of the mental health system for years get free of stuff, and all of a sudden the lights are on and they're helping other people, and their kid, they got their kids back and all kind. I mean, we see some amazing stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the one place I made a lot of amends in early sobriety without the guidance of that I should have had. And I really ask the guys I sponsor, especially in this area, don't do this alone. The alcoholic mind is the great trickster. The ego is devious. And a couple things that I'd like to read a couple little passages out of the book. One is on the bottom of 77 through to the top of 78. Bill Wilson says something three times in one paragraph. I have a great respect for Bill's ability as a wordsmith. And if he says something once, I heed it. If he says it twice, I think it's important. If he says it three times in different words in the same paragraph, he's trying to get this. And this is such a crucial thing he's talking about in amends here. I'm making amends to people who I don't even think I need to. Going into the fourth step, these are the people that really owe me an amends. And now I'm coming out the other side, and through This Was Our Course and the process and the fourth step, I'm starting to look at it from a different angle now. And I'm starting to see it through their eyes, and I'm starting to look at my side of the street and realize what I did. And I'm not hiding my own selfish, vindictive, self-seeking behavior in the shadow of what they did wrong anymore. And I'm starting to look dead on at my actions. It's not a pretty sight. I was great at hiding the what a terrible son I was, and behind the shadow of the imperfections of my mother and father. What a terrible employee I was, because I could find something wrong with my boss. Or what a terrible boyfriend I was because I could find something wrong with my girlfriend. And how often I would stare at the defects and the problems and the imperfections of others to justify myself. And so here I got to do this completely different. And one of the things that happens is because I had the remnants of this judgment, the ego does not like to give up a judgment. It just, I think I got the kind of ego that it doesn't care if it kills me, as long as after I'm dead, everybody thinks, well, that, at least that Bob was right. I mean, he's dead, but he's right. And so Bill says it three times, and he says it the first time at the top line in the last paragraph on 77. He says, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. That sounds simple enough, but some of these people, it's not criticism, but they need a little correction. Do you ever notice? I mean, just a little tweaking. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do this. So then here he says it again, using different words, coming at it from a different angle, same thing. Never trying to tell him what he should do. Never? But they need to know, don't they? No, they never, never. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. Three times. Because he knows, Bill knows me. He knows, I think he knows us. Here's a guy that's hurt you, but you've changed your attitude. You realize he's a sick man, couldn't help it. And now you've cleaned up your side of the street. You made amends. You paid him the money or whatever the deal was that was your side of the street. At that point, after humbling yourself like that, the temptation to want to straighten him out for his own good, it's just overwhelming. And yet, if I go down that road even a meter, I will undo everything I've come here to do. Some amends, one of the things my ego does is it wants to stay in the right and wrong business. I won't make amends to certain people because they were wrong. But it's only the ego that's in the right and wrong business. The spirit just yearns for connectivity. It yearns for restoration. That's all. It's not in the right or wrong business. I've had to make amends many times in sobriety to people that if you were to put it on any kind of justice scale, anyone would admit that, well, they were really the ones that were wrong. Why are you making the amends? Because I have the tools to mend the separation between me and them. They don't have the tools. And so the buck stops here. And that's really what I'm trying to do. It's not right or wrong. It's about mending the separation between me and another one of God's kids. And sometimes it's just a matter of forgiveness. Sometimes it's a matter to give for them the same thing I would want people to give for me. The same tolerance that has to be given, the same love, the same consideration, the same compassion, the same understanding and acceptance. I got to give it for them, because if I was screwed up, how desperately I'd want you to give it for me. And so I give it to you. And if there's something I've done that's actually hurt, how do you know if you've hurt someone? Well, I think one of the great exercises here is that and it talks about this in step 12, but I use it with the guys I sponsor in step 8 and 9, is to put yourself in the place of the person you're going to approach and approach them the way you would like to be approached if the tables were turned. In other words, sit within yourself in meditation in a place where you really get what it must have felt like to experience what you were dishing out. No matter how much you justified it, take away the justification. And now what did it feel like to be there? And God, we do that with some people. It's horrific what we find out. You start seeing from your mother and father's point of view what kind of a child I was, or what kind of son I was. See, I don't want to look at that. I want to look at what you did wrong. And then when I really get it, the great awakening in that is now I have, with God's grace, and boy, God's grace has to be in here too. With God's grace, I have the ability to come to that person and say the things to them that possibly someone could say to me if I had been hurt the way they'd been hurt by someone like me. And the words will come, and they'll be the right words, because there's a commonality here. See, what will work for you is the same thing that would probably work for me. But yeah, I have to be clear enough and out of myself enough to get you, and awake enough to get you, in order to know exactly what your experience was, so that I can talk to you the way I'd want someone to talk to me if I'd been hurt like that. And that is that's a powerful, powerful thing. And it makes perfect sense that we'd come at some of this stuff from an other-centered perspective, being self-centered people. The answer would have to be in something very different. You know, I love what Sandy said, and Chuck used to say all the time, about there's one problem that concludes all problems, and one solution contains all solutions. And the delusion is that you can find the solution in the problem. You can stare at that problem. You can go to discussion meetings and discuss that problem. You can talk about that problem. You will never find the solution within the problem. The solution is different. And the implication, the action is different. It never occurs to me that when I resent you in order to be free from the resentment that I have to make amends to you when in my way of thinking, you're the one that really needs to make amends to me. And yet it has to go that way. I had an experience with a guy about a year or so ago, a little longer than a year. He did a fifth step with me. And he had a lot of resentments that were really causing him a lot of problems in his company at work. And we talked about him, and he went through, this was our course, and he could really take a clear look at where he was at fault and where he'd been selfish and et cetera. And he had an awakening with that, and it was very cool. 6 months later, he wants to do another inventory, another fifth step. I'm a little hesitant to do too close together. But he built a pretty good case. He says, I really need to. I'm really jammed up about some stuff. And I said, okay. I said, God, you really screwed that up in a short period of time. And I said, okay. And so we start doing this fifth step, and I stopped him a little bit into it. I said, these are the exact same resentments. He said, yeah, but they're still eating my lunch. I'm having a lot of problems with them. I said, well, did you make the amends? He looked at me like a deer in the headlights, like, what's that have to do with anything? I said, you're not going to get free of any of this stuff. Your ego is vested in re-feeling the wrong they did until you make it right. You'll never get free of the resentment until you go to them and make it right. And that has been real true in my life. If I do something to hurt you, I am not free of it. I will. It's almost like my ego demands to build a case against you to justify my separate position, the fact that I owe you. And if I want to be free, then I have to push myself aside and get out of the right and wrong business and just go and make it right, regardless. And I think that's the premier question here is, do you want to be free or do you want to be right? It's always that way. And I sponsor guys, and this what I'm about to say is sort of, it's an experiential opinion, which is in itself, that's like Army intelligence. But I think that there's a cause and effect between amends and the things that happen in my life today. I can't always see it. I don't know 100% that it's always that way. I'm willing to believe that some stuff can be happenstance, but I have seen evidence in my own experience of the cause and effect. And I could tell you stories about financial stuff that I've had to clear up with over 20 years of sobriety that I was paying a price for. And I think it's karma. I didn't know what karma was until I heard a series of talks by Alan Watts, and Bill had mentioned Alan. Alan, I grew up reading Alan Watts. One of my favorite therapists I ever went to studied with him. And Watts, in this one talk, he talked about the word karma, and I'd never heard that. He said if the literal translation of the word karma into the English out of the Hindi would be translated as the word doing, that I hurt these people over here, or I owe you money financially and I've never paid it back and nobody's pressuring me and I think I got away with something, and now I'm having a lot of bad luck financially over here, that it's really my doing. And that's almost impossible to see, because a lot of times it seems absolutely disconnected, and yet I've experienced the cause and effect. I'll take a minute to tell you this one story. I was over 20 years sober, and I got a shipment of merchandise in, almost over $23,000 worth of stuff with no invoice. No, it was just a bill of lading, not unusual. It was stuff we brought out, a truckload of stuff from another state. I used to do a lot of that stuff. I was trying to emulate, one of my great mentors was a guy named Joe Colon who started Trader Joe's, and we did a lot of that kind of stuff. And I figured the company that cleared this merchandise will send me an invoice after they have to hand enter the data to the database, because it's not merchandise in their database, so it's all outside their database, and they'll send me an invoice and they get their 10% for doing it. And I thought, no problem. And a month, next month came by, no invoice. I said, well, it'll probably, they're behind, they're swamped. Give them another month. Another month came by, no invoice. I said to my office manager, Linda, who was one of the great untreated Al-Anons of the world. I mean, oh my God, she was so loyal. I told her one time, if I had 10 people like you, I'd conquer the world. She was amazing. She had my back to almost to a fault. She would, and I said to Linda, I said, call this company up and offer and tell them that we need to send them the check and et cetera. And she called him up, and she didn't do what I told her to do because she's overprotective of me. Instead, she called him up, and she said, would you go through your records and see if there's any possibility that there's an outstanding invoice and something we owe you? And they went by, and they said, no, we don't. No, you don't know. You're good. Matter of fact, you don't owe us anything. She came into my office. She was excited. She said, we don't owe them anything. I said, oh, Linda, we got to pay that bill. We have to pay that bill. And she said to me, well, why don't we wait till after the holidays? Because our cash flow will be so strong over the holidays in retail, you just be easy then. And the evil voice said, well, that makes perfect sense. And I put my own distorted personality ahead of the principal, and I went for that. I could have wrote the check then. And I didn't. I listened to in my own head, and the holidays weren't that good that year. And my business started sort of spiraling down. The next year was kind of frightening, really. The next holiday business, we just barely paid our bills. And it's progressing, and I'll tell you, it's getting worse and worse. And I don't understand the cause and effect. And then one day, I'll tell you, it was like a veil lifted. And I knew it. I couldn't prove it logically because there's no connection. Nobody knows I owe this money. I can't pinpoint one thing I've done to sabotage my life. And I'm not a dumb guy. If I was doing something to sabotage my life, I'm sure I could see it. I could not see it. And yet my intuitive sense told me that this is a cause and effect here. Somehow this is my doing. I don't know how it is. I can't see it, but I get it. And I went through. I'll tell you, sometimes these big companies, it's almost impossible to pay them money. They're adamantly sure you don't owe them. I mean, I had to go through the ringer. I finally got them to accept the check, and I sent them the check, and it was amazing. I just all of a sudden, things are getting better. Now, you could say it's coincidence. You could say it's happenstance. In no time at all, a guy, one of my competitors, came along and offered to buy the last of my company. And I was able to retire. And he gave me a price and put me in a position. I was able to retire, and it was good. It was good. I think that was my doing. I'll never be able to prove that, but I believe that. And I've watched it in guys I sponsor who have those amends that they never paid back. And now they're 25 years sober and they got a lot of problems financially. And if you sit down and have a conversation with them, what have you left out? Who told you didn't have to pay them, that you knew you owed them and you went with it? Who did you never pay back that you think you got away with something? And I've watched guys go and do that stuff and watch the change, the cause and effect. In page 127 in the big book, it says something. It's a statement of spiritual cause and effect. And I really believe in this. And it says, even though financial, right in the middle of the page, it says, although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. And here it is. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded it. What does that mean? If you make all your financial amends, you're going to be rich? Nah. I know guys make 7 figures a year that have no material well-being. I know people who make 30,000-40,000 a year that have tremendous spiritual well-being because they're right with themselves, they're right with God, and they're right with the people in their lives. I don't want to. Material well-being is not contingent on decimal points.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.